Okay, thank you, Laurette. Oh, okay, thank you. And I'd like to thank the organisers for the invitation. I realised this morning at breakfast quite what an illustrious meeting this was when one of the organisers asked me, are you going to give a talk dressed like that? So I'm afraid... you were there, yeah? Okay, so apologies for my clothes. So what I'd like to talk about today is work that actually I started with Brad Marsden when we were both organising separate KITP programmes, which shows the benefit in 2008. And I have a number of other collaborators, Greg's in the room. And what I'd like to do is talk about what we call the generalised quasi-linear approximation. And I have three potential applications. I'll probably only manage to get through one, but we'll see how we go. And so the motivation comes from geophysical and astrophysical fluids, so a slightly different motivation. And of course, in geophysics and astrophysics, we need to go beyond DNS because we can't simply simulate the flows. But where can we go? And I shouldn't need to motivate to this audience that we should go to some kind of reduced models. I'll talk about the quasi-linear approximation and then how one might generalize the quasi-linear approximations. And so this is what John, when he invited me, called the big bad flows of AGFD. He thought you had to learn about the big bad flows. Of course, what I'm going to apply it to are not really big bad flows, but kind of small mischievous flows. But still, so we have Jupiter, we have the Earth here, we have the solar cycle, and this is the other guy's program, the accretion disks. And the only thing I'd like you to take from all these movies is that despite the fact that all of these systems, this one's not a movie in case you're waiting for it to do something, the thing to take from all these systems is despite the fact that there are very high Reynolds numbers, and you can play the game of who's at higher Reynolds number, and doing simulations of galaxy clusters, I guess, would put you at the highest Reynolds number. Despite the fact that these are all at very high Reynolds number, there is some order from the chaos, hopefully, and hopefully that you can describe at least some of these systems using reduced models. Okay. Oh, okay. This is something funny here. Okay. So, as I say, it's often important to derive reduced models to yield insights. And I've put up three ways. I'm sure you can all think of many ways of doing this. Of course, you could use dynamical systems theory, which is obviously very popular in this conference, to try and find the building blocks of turbulence. And you calculate fully nonlinear solutions, and then you hope to build up your full solution from these fully nonlinear solutions. You could use asymptotic theories, so talked by Keith and Greg later on in the week, and you derive models that you know are valid in some asymptotic wedge in parameter space, so perhaps the Rossby number of your flow is very small. You use this as a small parameter, you get a separation of timescales, and you use this to derive a reduced model. And I should say, often these models extend well beyond, the validity of the model extends well beyond the formal limits of the theory, so they're very useful. And I would say if you can do that, you certainly should do that. And then there's this whole branch of models that I've become interested in the last few years, these statistical models. And this is to answer maybe a different question than the ones most of you are trying to answer, where you're trying to get a handle on a reduced model for the dynamics of the system. Perhaps for astrophysical flows, it's more appropriate to try and get a reduced model of the statistical properties of a system. Because if I could answer a simple question like if one has a star, does it rotate faster at the poles than the equator, which is really a statistical question, I'd be very happy. Of course, I can't answer that question. The sun rotates faster at the equator, but other stars don't. So one might like to know something about the statistical properties of a system, or perhaps the statistical properties of certain unresolved scales. So even if you are interested in the dynamics, then you might want to build a subgrid scale model, so a model of what's happening at smaller scales than the ones you can resolve, that relies on some kind of statistical properties of the scales that you haven't resolved. And all of these statistical models rely on some kind of truncation or approximation, and often these are unwarranted truncations or approximations, so we can make progress. So a lot of the early work was assuming homogeneity and isotropy, but this branch of modelling has become popular over the last few years. I've put down a few of the groups who look at this. I'm not going to talk about this today. What I am going to talk about is these truncations or approximations and relate them back to some of the questions that at least we were discussing last week, which is when can one use a simplified quasi-linear theory? Okay. That was a big yawn. Who was that? Okay. Thank you. So one can think of two types of turbulent interactions with mean flows. You can think of energy being input at small or moderate scales, and the large scales or the mean flows emerge owing to correlations in the turbulence. Maybe these correlations are there because of rotation or stratification. Or you can think of the types of problems that have been discussed mainly today, where one has a large-scale flow, then that goes unstable. It goes unstable to some turbulence, and that turbulence acts so as to rearrange the large scales. And I'm going to give one example of this type, and perhaps two examples of this type, where one's going to look at the approximations that one can make and see how well that they work. So why are people interested in simulating the statistics? Well, the low-order statistics are probably smoother in space than the instantaneous flow, so you might be able to describe them with a fewer degrees of freedom. And these statistics probably evolve slowly in time, or perhaps not at all. They might evolve on a slow manifold. What statistics are we talking about? They usually describe the mean average behavior and variations about that mean. So if you one's interested in spatial dynamics, you might be interested in the two-point correlation functions. And the hope is, at least in astrophysics, where the parameters are huge, the hope is that the statistics are less sensitive to the changes in the underlying parameters than the detailed dynamics. But it's worth noticing, not just in experiments, but certainly in geophysics and astrophysics, that the correlations are non-local, highly anisotropic and inhomogeneous, and highly inhomogeneous. And so the statistical formulation should respect this. And hopefully they should also respect conservation laws. Okay. So I'm going to talk about the quasi-linear approximation. And this is something we're all happy with, and it's been used a number of times. So what you do is you take your state variable, which I'll call Q, which you can think of as a vector of all your variables, so your velocity, your temperature, your pressure, magnetic field if it's important. You divide it into a mean and fluctuations about that mean. Now, in this talk, I'm going to talk about spatial fluctuations about a spatial mean, but I think this can all be extended to ensemble means and temporal means. So let's think about these, what the quasi-linear approximation means. I take my mean, which is given by Q average, and the quasi-linear approximation is essentially we're keeping certain triad interactions, if one thinks of it in say, spectral space. So I keep the interaction of the mean with the fluctuation to give me a fluctuation. That's the regular linear thing. Then the mean evolves, of course. The mean evolves because of a fluctuation-fluctuation interaction into the mean. But what I'm going to throw away is this fluctuation-fluctuation going to a fluctuation interaction. And sometimes this is called the eddy-eddy nonlinearity. And in mean field electrodynamics, people call this the pain in the neck term, okay, because it's a pain in the neck. Okay, and usually the rationalization for this is that one says, well, one has a mean flow and the eddies are sheared apart quickly by the mean flow, and so the eddy-eddy going to eddy interactions might be secondary of secondary importance. So you can show that, of course, this approximation is exact in certain asymptotic limits, but what's nice about it, because this is an example, essentially one's removing triad interactions in pairs, that's what one's doing, then there's a conservation of global, linear, and quadratic invariance, which is a nice thing to have. And so when one looks at the means and the fluctuations and looks at the total energy, or the total any quadratic invariant, that remains constant. And so there's a self-consistent transfer of whatever property you're interested in from the large scales to the small scales. But of course, one's removed the local cascade or inverse cascade. Okay. Okay. Just to say, the inhomogeneous statistical formulation of this is sometimes called CE2, or stochastic structural stability theory, which I think Navid will talk about on Wednesday, Tuesday, I don't know. Yeah. Okay. So sometimes in fluid mechanics and in plasma physics, the effectiveness of this approximation is measured by what's called the Q-bone number. And here's the Q-bone number for fluid mechanics. And you see, unfortunately, this number, which measures how important the eddy-eddy interactions is in your system, you can only work this out once you've done the calculation. So you do your calculation, and you work out the correlation time of your turbulence and the correlation length in the UR and S, and you say, oh, I could have done that quasi-linearly. Well, okay. But it's a useful check. And if this approximation works, the mean adjusts solely owing to perturbation-perturbation interactions. So, and the perturbations only respond to the mean. And we've seen, last week, we saw some examples of when this does work. Okay. You can show that as one moves away from statistical equilibrium, this C2 or S3T can break down. So one might want to go further. Okay, I'm not going to say too much here. So you can think of this kind of state diagram or something, and you can think of where your problem might lie in the kind of Q-bone number space. So over here, the quasi-linear approximation is going to work, we think. So for weakly nonlinear systems, this is something Lorette showed last week, which has the Arzeff property. The Arzeff property, I believe, is just a restatement of the fact that you can describe this with a quasi-linear system. Jupiter, we believe, potentially can be described, the jets on Jupiter, with a quasi-linear system. As one moves across here, this is homogeneous isotropic turbulence. Of course, homogeneous isotropic turbulence, all the interesting behavior is in the eddy-eddy going to eddy nonlinearities. And so one wouldn't use this kind of approach for something like that. But the hope is that for some of these problems in the middle, you might be able to get away with it. Okay. Now then, one might think about generalizing this, and this is what I'm talking about today. I talked about a mean and the fluctuations, but I'm going to try and generalize this to large scales and small scales, spatial scales in this case, okay? And so one can think of triad interactions again. So again, think of a spatial wave number, and I'm going to take my large scales to be all of those all of the wave numbers less than some cutoff wave number lambda, and small scales, or the high modes, to be all of those scales which are shorter than that cutoff lambda. And again, in order to preserve the conservation laws, I'm going to look at decimating triads in pairs. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to keep the self-consistent interaction of the large scales to give me large scales. As before, I'm going to keep my small scale going to large scales, and I also have this large scale with small scale going to small scales, and I'm going to ignore or take out all of these interactions. And this is different in terms of where your energy can go. Because if you think about it, energy, or whatever you're interested in, can be scattered between short-scale modes of different wave numbers by scattering off a mean. So to put it precisely, let's say I have a k equals 10 mode. Before, it could only interact with a k equals 0 mode and give energy to the k equals 0 mode and then put that back into the k equals 10 mode. But now a k equals 0 mode could interact with a k equals 1 mode to give me a k equals 11 mode, and that can carry on. I could also get a k equals 10 interacting with a k equals minus 9 to give me back the large scales. So there's more avenues for transfer of energy. These are non-local in spectral space transfers. Okay. So I'm going to talk about three different problems to test how well QL and GQL do, and we've tested them in three paradigm problems. This one is probably all I'll have time to talk about, maybe. This is the driving of jets on a 2D spherical surface or beta plane This one I've put in because I'm actually in the other program, and this is of relevance to accretion disks, so I think I better put this in. This is the, what's called the helical magnetorotational instability. You can think of it as Taylor-Couette flow that's magnetized. So this is an example of where one forces the small scales and gets a large-scale flow out. Here's one where we have a large-scale flow, which is the flow between two cylinders with a magnetic field, and that goes unstable to generate turbulence. And then the final one is on rotating Couette flow. So this is that these two are two-dimensional problems. So one has the choice of how many modes to keep in just one direction. And this one is a 3D, so one has an interesting choice of how many modes to keep in the streamwise and the spanwise direction. Okay. So let's have a look at this paradigm problem. So the first one was the driving of jets on a spherical surface. So I'm looking at the evolution, in this case, just of the radial components of the vorticity on a spherical surface. I have some driving. This is my nonlinear term. This is the u dot grad u term. And then I have some frictional terms. These are linear frictional terms. And it's very well understood for a long time. There's been a lot of work on this problem. What the dynamics of this problem is. So let me just show you what this is, what the dynamics is. Okay, so here I am, I'm forcing at moderate scales, and then the flow goes nonlinear. And you can see these vortices, these nice turbulent vortices, red and blue. I'm showing the relative vorticity. And after a time, probably about 100 rotation periods, this flow is going to sort itself out such that there's mainly red in the northern hemisphere, just above the equator, and mainly blue in the southern hemisphere. You can see it there. And so this means if I average over one direction, in this case, the azimuthal angle, I'm going to get mainly blue here, mainly red here. And this relative vorticity is the signature of an equatorial jet. So I have an equatorial jet, prograde equatorial jet, and I have retrograde jets at higher latitudes. So one can see this by looking at the so-called Hofmoller plots. So if at each time you average over azimuth and plot the average as a function of latitude and time, you get a plot that looks like the top plot for the zonal vorticity and a plot that looks like this plot for the zonal relative velocity. So this is the equatorial prograde jet, these are the retrograde jets. And at this time, I start averaging over time as well to find some well-converged statistics. So by the end of this, hopefully I have some well-converged statistics to try and test out whether I can reproduce them. Okay, so that would be my mean flow. And oh no, it doesn't work like that, does it? So here's my mean flow. Just have a look at the black line for the minute. You can see that at the equator, we have a prograde jet, and at mid latitudes we have these retrograde jets in the black line. Now, a quasi-linear approximation, and I'll come back to this, it reproduces the mean shape of the equatorial jet quite well. But it doesn't do so well near the poles, and that's because we're driving in Legendre modes, and our driving was located closer to the equator, and because there's no eddy-eddy going to eddy scattering, or no way of getting energy off the mean, there's no way of getting energy towards the poles, and this is why a quasi-linear approximation here doesn't do very well. What about higher-order statistics? Well, what you can do is plot the two-point correlation function. So what I'm plotting here, I've got latitude and longitude, and there's a black spot in the middle, so I'm plotting the two-point correlation function of the vorticity with the point indicated here. So here's a point at mid-latitudes, here's a point at the equator, and you can see there's a signature of the Rossby waves in this case. This is a signature of the mean driving of the large-scale flow. So one can see that there is a well-defined wave number, although it's modulated, and this is the signature of the wave forcing of the large-scale flow. Okay, so so this was using a quasi-linear model. How does taking this to a generalized quasi-linear model with a cutoff do? Okay. So again, the black line here is DNS, essentially. The green line is a quasi-linear model. Okay, and again, it suffers from the same deficiencies as we had before. This is for slightly different parameters. And the red line is the generalized quasi-linear model for lambda equals 3. Now, remember, lambda was the cutoff between what I'm calling large scales and small scales. So lambda equals 0 goes back to being the quasi-linear model. So even if I only take 3 modes in as being large scales, I get a significant improvement in my results. There's a significant improvement in the mean, but even more so, there's a significant improvement in the two-point correlation function. At the top is the result from DNS. This is the result from the quasi-linear model, and this is the result from the generalized quasi-linear model with lambda equals 3, and you can see that the quasi-linear model overemphasizes the importance of long-range correlations, and it overemphasizes the importance of the Rossby wave. And that's not really surprising, because there's no way of getting energy out of the Rossby wave, because if you put it in the mean, it can only go back into that Rossby wave. Whereas if you're able to scatter this into different wave numbers, you can get a better result. And that's kind of borne out by, if one looks at a vorticity power spectrum, this is the power spectrum for what we're calling the truth, the DNS. It's not really the truth, it's a DNS model, but still. So we force at high wave numbers, and then we get a mean flow, that's the m equals 0 mode. For the lambda equals 0 mode, of course, the mean flow evolves. It undergoes an instability. So this is an example of a mean flow evolving and undergoing an instability and generating something at this wave number. But there's no way of getting energy into these intermediate wave numbers. Whereas the generalized quasi-linear approximation, because it can scatter this energy off the mean, can do a better job at reproducing the truth, quote truth. Okay, so I won't say anything about that. Now, if one does the same problem on the beta plane, you get similar results. But what's nice in this geometry is that you can actually derive an asymptotic theory based on an expansion in small parameters. In this case, the small parameter can be related to the ratio of dissipation to forcing. So one can derive an asymptotic theory where you get an self-consistent evolution of the large scales and the small scales, which exactly respects the GQL approximation that you've made. Okay. So apologies to those people who came specifically to hear me talk about the MRI, but I won't. Same thing happens for the MRI, and this is another 2D problem. So, okay, let me just say that's the two-point correlation function for DNS. This is what happens. Again, you overestimate long-range correlations if one does a quasi-linear model, and if one does a generalized quasi-linear model, you do a better chance. You have a better chance. Okay, but let me get on to a 3D system. Oh, the MRI should be 3D. We just did it in 2D. Sorry. Okay, so we're looking at rotating Couette flow, which of course is of interest for many reasons. It's the narrow gap limit of Taylor Couette flow. There are lots of beautiful experiments that are done. So one has two parallel plates, you move them at speed plus or minus u, and then you rotate the system. Okay, and there's some very nice complicated dynamics that even at moderate Reynolds numbers, you get a coexistence of coherent structures and turbulence. Which is very interesting, and they're both responsible for transporting momentum. There are two important non-dimensional parameters, the Reynolds number and what I like to think of the Rossby number. So the Rossby number is u over 2 omega h. Now just be careful if you do GAFD. In the literature, they use the rotation number, which is RO, which is 2 omega h over u. So the Rossby number is 1 over the rotation number. Be a bit careful. So I'm going to quote Rossby numbers because I do GNFD. Okay, so let me just show you what happens for the one we're testing. Whoops. Okay, this is not a good movie. So we did lots of different parameters, but the one that we're trying to reproduce here evolves through a state with three stripes to a state which has two wavy cells, okay? And there's transport both by these coherent structures plus the turbulence around those. Okay, so this is a snapshot of the flow, and this is what the mean flow looks like. So you should just be looking at the red curve here. This is what the power spectrum in a horizontal plane looks like. And this is what the two-point correlation function for this flow looks like from DNS. So this is what we're trying to reproduce. Now, of course, in this system, we have a choice of cutoff wave numbers. We could keep different cutoff wave numbers in X and in Y. Okay, so we have a choice, and it's not clear that you should keep the same number of modes in X as you do in Y, because, of course, the flow is very anisotropic, right? The streamwise and the spanwise direction are very different. So what's the best strategy? And the answer is we don't know. But let me show you what we figured out, what the best strategy is not. Okay, so this is a close-up of how well you reproduce the mean flow. So we're just doing it so you can really see the differences. So the black dashed curve is the truth, right? If you believe DNS to be the truth. The blue curve here is something that's quasi-linear in both directions. So we've taken lambda in the x direction and lambda in the y direction to be both zero. The others just look like a mishmash, and you can only really understand what's happening by looking at the dissipation rate, but I didn't want to put a big table on. Let me tell you that you can get a very good answer by taking lambda 5 in both directions. Let me point out a couple of other things. That you could imagine taking a fully nonlinear model, say in the streamwise direction, and a quasi-linear model in the spanwise direction, or vice versa. You could take a quasi-linear model in the streamwise, fully nonlinear in the spanwise, and you can play all these games and see how well they do. And how well they do is really given by the power spectrum in the horizontal plane. So the one on the top left is truth. Okay. The one top right is the fully quasi-linear model. This is one which is, let me get this right, quasi-linear in the x direction. This one is quasi-linear in the y direction. And all of these are different combinations of this GQL approximation. And if you're quasi-linear in one direction, you still cannot scatter energy in that direction. Okay, so you're more likely to get not such a good result. And that is, I don't really have time to say this, this is reflected in the two-point correlation function. Okay, so why really am I doing this? Of course, I want to know when the quasi-linear approximation works quite well, but it can lead to a closure for direct statistical simulation. And so if you have your state variable, which has a linear bit and a nonlinear bit, and you put it into low and high modes, then one can write down an equation for the evolution of the low modes. Sorry, I've missed out the linear terms here. So this is the low-low interactions going to the low, the high-high interactions going to the low. You're going to tell me how long I've got, like minus a minute? Yeah, okay, good. And this is the high one evolving according to the lows. And then you can close the system because you can write an equation for the high-high correlations, because the equation for highs is formally linear. It's formally linear. Okay, yes, thank you for that. Okay, I don't want to say anything about that or that, so I'll go to my conclusions. So, just to say, the quasi-linear approximation can be valid in cases where the projection of the third cumulant, this is another way of saying the same thing, onto the second cumulant is small. That's a low Kubo number flow. I think it's fair to say a better approximation is the generalized quasi-linear approximation, which generalizes the definition of what you mean by a mean to large scales. And I think the primary reason is that it allows for the scattering of energy from eddies at one scale to another. it's nice that it conserves quadratic invariants, and it can form the basis of a statistical closure. I think we can generalize this to not just spatial scales, but time scales. And this is the long-term plan. It's hopefully, if you're doing a DNS, and you've got some resolved scales, then we could use this GQL, or the statistical formalism of that, to do a kind of self-consistent statistical subgrid scale model. So thank you for your attention.
Daniel Aquine, Princeton. So practically speaking, how much easier is it to do, in terms of computational costs, is it to do a QL versus GQL with Lambda versus DNS?
Yeah, so if one can get away with, okay, so if you do the full problem, the full problem, then you start getting as computationally expensive as DNS as soon as you go to start doing GQL. But the bit I didn't say is that we're hoping to use, we have all these statistical quantities that we have to compute. So why not use POD to reduce the amount of modes that you need to compute these statistical quantities? And Brad's student, Alton Awala, has looked at this problem, and you can get an enormous reduction. So if you do the dumb thing, which is what Brad and I were doing, of course, then it could be quite expensive. But if you then do something smart, then there's going to be some real savings. And the POD is going to work well because, as I said, these statistics, they're smooth in space. Okay, so you're doing a POD of, say, something that looks like, okay, oops, POD of something, this is a second cumulant, okay, with 600 modes, and this is what it looks like with one, and this is what it looks like with three. So if you could do that, then you should do that, and hopefully we will do that.
Joe Kluwicki, University of New Hampshire. Is there a methodology for picking the value for Lambda?
Not at the moment, no. Trial and error. All the problems we've worked with, providing you keep a few, by few I mean towards five modes, then you have enough scattering off the large scales into the small scales that you get decent results, but that's not a proof in any sense. But we're working on that. Brad might like to comment.
One comment to make, this is Brad Marston from Brown, is that it's systematic in the sense that as you increase Lambda, you're including more and more nonlinear processes. So at some point, it will agree with the fully nonlinear model. So at least you have that.
Yeah, so at one end, it agrees with QL, and at the other end, it agrees with DNS. That's where you put the thing in the middle. We don't know. Somebody looked like you, just asked the question.
Still Daniel Aquine, Princeton. What you would really be interested in doing this for is a problem that you couldn't do a DNS of. So if you did this GQL and you changed Lambda, it seems like you found that if Lambda is large enough, then you recover the DNS because you already know what the DNS is. But if you didn't, presumably, maybe you would find that would converge to some value, converge to some solution.
Yeah.
But you might be fooled. Maybe it converges to the wrong thing before converging to the right thing.
That's right.
So has that happened, or does it always just go to the correct answer right away, or?
Okay. Well, there's two things I'd like to say. The first is how many comparisons with DNS you have to do before the audience believes what you're doing without doing the DNS. And the answer is there is no number that you can give that for which that's true. I mean, so the second is it's definitely right that you can get the wrong answer, particularly if there's like strong symmetries in the problem and somehow you haven't quite captured the symmetry. So you could be fooled.
Thank you, Steve.